This is Ahval Online, meeting point of accurate news and free comment on the current affairs of Turkey. Welcome to our podcast series.
Hello, and welcome to Talking Turkey. I'm your host, Ahval editor David Lepeska, and with me today is returning guest Merve Tahiroğlu, Turkey program coordinator for the Project on Middle East Democracy. Hello, Merve, and thanks for joining us again.
Hi, David. Thank you for having me.
You are welcome. We are speaking on Wednesday, July 29th. Just this morning, Turkey's parliament passed a new social media law that, according to international observers like Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International, gives the Turkish government considerably more power to censor and even control online activity. Under the new law, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, and other platforms must hire a representative in Turkey or face a bandwidth restriction of up to 90%, which would essentially make them unusable in Turkey. Hiring a representative in Turkey would mean first that the platform would be forced to comply with Turkish government requests in 48 hours or face significant fines. And second, that the user data on those platforms would be subject to governmental removal. As you detailed last month, Merve, in a report for Tel Aviv University's Dayan Center for Middle East and African Studies, the Turkish government had already increased its policing of social media in the first few months of the pandemic. Now comes this new law, which computer science professor Murat Yüksel just said on Twitter an hour or so ago, quote, essentially means that dissident activity over social media is banned in Turkey. So, Merve, just how problematic to you is this new law? To what extent do you see it further restricting government criticism online?
Well, David, thank you for this question. I think it's a very, very concerning development what we're seeing here with social media, because as you mentioned, I mean, the Turkish government, and I've detailed this, the Turkish government has been trying to do information control in Turkey for a very long time. For any authoritarian regime, this is one of the most important tools to sustain the durability of that regime against any kind of popular opposition or criticism. And Erdogan has really become a master in this in Turkey. He's basically taken over almost all of traditional media. We have very, very few newspapers, online outlets, or news channels that actually do not entirely toe the government's line, if not is not directly owned by Erdogan's family or friends in the business community. So what that means is that social media is one of the very few platforms where Turkish people can speak relative freedom. And this was already problematic in Turkey because of the mountains of court cases that were already launched against citizens, journalists, politicians for their commentary on social media. Often we see these individuals being targeted either for insulting the presidency or insulting the government, insulting the flag, or worse, terrorism propaganda or supporting terrorism in other ways. So these are pretty grievous crimes already that Turkish people were facing for using their freedom of expression on social media. Now we're going to see a much closer to Turkish government monitoring of this space, and the idea that these social media companies have to now store their data in Turkey and be directly responsible for engaging with these court requests to not only block these websites but to actually remove content means that the government and really the Erdogan regime's policing of social public opinion has moved on to the social media space. Again, one of the few places remaining for the Turkish public discourse to take place without so much intervention. And now we're about to see that being stripped off of them as well. A lot of people are talking about whether this will make Turkey something like a Chinese model, where Erdogan will essentially trying to control and police the entire internet space and Turkish people's engagement with that space. So I think all of this is very, very concerning.
Speaking of a previous but quite similar iteration of this bill, academic and cyber rights activist Yaman Akdeniz told me that social media platforms will now be forced to either give up the lucrative Turkish market or become, in essence, a puppet of an authoritarian government. As of this podcast on Wednesday morning, as far as I know, we've yet to hear from the social media platforms on this new law. I wonder how you think they might respond. Do you see these platforms like Twitter and Facebook accepting these restrictions and appointing a Turkey representative? And if so, if they did that, to what extent would that possibly undermine sort of the integrity of these platforms in Turkey?
Well, the problem with these big tech companies and tech platforms in general is that these are for-profit companies at the end of the day, and they will always care about, as you said, going into these lucrative markets like Turkey, and we see this sort of everywhere in places like Egypt too, where particularly in under repressive regimes, people will go in droves towards social media, and we do see a high social media usage. Mostly in economically middle or lower country groups. There's more interest in social media. Most people have smartphones and they use much of their time on these social media platforms and also on places like Netflix. So for these companies, being able to operate in these difficult regions is very important. And I think at the end of the day, they will try to compromise in order to make that work. And this is one of the bigger problems that we're facing in terms of technology and democratization today, that these social media companies, whether when it comes to disinformation or allowing repressive regimes to control their content or help these regimes police their content in their own countries where they operate, is something that these social media companies are not very good at doing, even with, you know, combating disinformation. You know, when we talk about removing content, so one of the issues with Turkey, for example, is that Turkey, until just a few years ago, was a major transit point for a lot of international jihadists trying to join the civil war in Syria. And they were passing through Turkey. And in the Turkish Twitter space and Facebook space, you would see a lot of content towards radicalization for actual terrorism sympathy. And these are the reasons why, you know, Twitter, for example, became just a few years ago one of the biggest, highest number of content removal requests would come from places like Turkey, where you had this kind of problem. But we're also seeing that for these regimes, these terrorism and content removal is not actually that interlinked. And particularly in Turkey, there's a huge hypocrisy in the way the government approaches this issue. Same thing with, you know, freedom of expression outside of the social media space, where we basically can see anyone, as long as they do not oppose the government or criticize the regime of President Erdogan, they can get away with saying pretty much anything, including sometimes pro-ISIS propaganda or pro-jihadi propaganda. But the critics, particularly, for example, under the pandemic, when Turkish doctors, civil doctors, were trying to raise questions about the pandemic and how the government sponsored measures might not be enough for citizens to protect themselves from catching the virus, we saw those people come under attack from the legal case. So there's never a clear approach towards this. It's always about repressing and policing criticism of the regime. And I worry that these social media companies, with an eye towards profit making, will have to succumb to some sort of deal with these governments. I'm not sure if these social media companies are going to accept all of the demands and the terms of this particular legislation in Turkey, because it would mean that they would have to store store their data there. It would mean they would, these representatives would have to deal with lots of legal cases. So they would have to hire, they would have to open new offices, hire lots of lawyers, as you can imagine. So it will be quite burdensome. And I think they will come under fire from the international community for doing so. But I do think that the general practice of these tech giant companies has so far been to maximize profit, and that means that they will try to find a compromise, unfortunately.
In your report for the Dayan Center that I mentioned, you write that public image is a top priority for Erdogan, that he's obsessed with keeping tabs on the public pulse, and that this control of the information space, rather than manipulating elections, is key to his staying in power. And indeed, after a vast media crackdown following the failed coup of 2016, Turkey's media landscape is today more than 90% pro-government. Only a handful of critical independent voices remain. And this has not gone unnoticed by Turkish citizens, apparently. A Center for American Progress report published last month found that 70% of those surveyed see Turkish media as biased and untrustworthy. And potentially surprising, this included 50% of AKP, of Erdogan and AKP supporters. I wonder what you think of this data point. Does it suggest that Erdogan's days of successfully shaping public opinion are numbered?
Well, this is actually a very interesting question, I think, because, look, at the end of the day, I mean, this is a hallmark of authoritarian regimes, right? Controlling information. And in the specific example of Turkey, numerous, coup regimes, for example, and other authoritarian governments in Turkey have long tried to do that through censorship. I mean, censorship is one of the most important tools for these authoritarian regimes. At the same time, history shows us, and the history of the world shows us, that it's impossible to keep tabs on information this way. It's impossible to control information. 21st century populist authoritarian leaders are facing, like Erdogan, are facing, is a challenge, because these people, I mean, this is even true for Vladimir Putin of Russia. They don't want to just say that, to portray themselves as sort of monarchical or hereditary leaders. They want to, oppressive as their regimes are and as authoritarian as they are, particularly in Turkey. I mean, Erdogan is clearly has a one-man regime. He's the only person making decisions effectively. But even so, even under these circumstances, they want to project some sort of popular support. And, in Turkey, that comes in the form of actual electoral support. And we see how important this is for a leader like Erdogan, who comes out after even an election that he wins with, 50.5%. Or 51%, he will come out and say, "See, I've got the popular will." It's very important for these types of leaders to be able to say that they have some sort of legitimacy when it comes to democratic politics, in that there is a large swath of public opinion that is supportive of their regimes. And this is why information control is so important for them. But I'm not sure that it's going to be able to work, because they aren't currently dealing with this kind of information control and suppression with 20th century tactics, but dealing with the 21st century digital space, where social media is the kind of thing where if you stop using one app, there will always be another app that comes out. There will always be a new website. If you shut down one, or if you remove content from one, there will always be new ones. You cannot really control the internet. And this is the fight that a leader like Erdogan is engaged in. He's trying to fight both the millennials, the youth that is growing up with very different values than he, and different policy proposals and ideas than he is. And he is trying to control them by controlling this huge internet space that he ultimately will fail to do, I believe. So as I'm very concerned about what this social media law means for Turkish citizens' ability to access free information, it also is a policy that is doomed to fail at the end of the day, because, again, this is the internet space. It's a whole new beast. And frankly, leaders like Erdogan don't quite know how to deal with it.
Another way of the government trying to show popular support is cracking down on public protest. A joint report of Turkish and European Union advocacy groups was published today, detailing Turkey's restrictions on freedom of assembly and how it undermines the work of human rights defenders and other activists. More than 4 years after the failed coup and 2 years after the end of the state of emergency, the study found that the space for civil society has dramatically narrowed in Turkey. One example they gave is that from January 2019 to January 2020, Turkish authorities issued 147 bans of varying lengths on assemblies and events in 25 cities across Turkey. The report said this crackdown has shown little sign of slowing and calls on the Turkish government to take a number of steps to increase the space for public assembly. Let's set those recommendations aside, because right now there seems to be little hope of this government moving in that direction. The report also called on international actors to take several steps to monitor the situation more closely, to conduct regular assessment visits to Turkey to spread awareness and issue recommendations to the Turkish government via public statements and diplomatic channels. Merve, I wonder, just how hard is it for activists and rights defenders in Turkey today to get their message out, to get their message to the public? And can international actors help improve the situation?
Well, in terms of the first question, just how hard it is for activists to get out this message, it depends on what you're advocating for. If you're advocating for the conversion of Hagia Sophia into a mosque, then streets are yours. Go ahead, right? You can have as many protests and chants and marches as you want in support of that. If you are trying to support, you know, Jerusalem Bay, which Turkey has, you basically are looking at a completely hypocritical space where if you're an LGBT activist or if you are condemning the government's inaction towards violence against women, if you are protesting femicides, basically murdering of women, if you are protesting for the rights of Kurdish citizens, if you're protesting for if the bar associations are all up in arms and trying to march against the parliament in order to stop them from completely changing their own internal election laws, then these people the police will intervene against them and will stop it, and they will say that, you know, we're going through an emergency times in Turkey and you're not allowed to protest. We've had LGBT pride marches cancelled for, I believe, the last 5 years at least, where they aren't allowed to do it. So it's really hard for anybody with a liberal or democratic or progressive agenda or anything in criticizing the government to actually go out and have these public demonstrations, which, you know, as we've been talking about, is pretty important, given that not only does the traditional media does not give them this kind of space, but increasingly social media is not going to allow them to have this space either. So for the streets, for these people, is the only thing really left, and they need to be able to use this. I mean, the freedom of assembly, like the freedom of expression, is a fundamental right in any democratic system, and this is one thing that the Turkish citizens should be able to do, and Erdogan should really allow it. And any democratic leader who, frankly, is not afraid of their own citizens should allow for these demonstrations, these non-violent, peaceful demonstrations to take place. I mean, here in America, we've had some trouble with that over this summer, as you know quite well, where not all of the protesters' rights were respected by every part of the U.S. government, but thankfully we have multiple forces that were trying to ensure that's right when the Black Lives Matter protests were happening because of the death of George Floyd just a month ago. So when I want to bring this to the international community and say that these kinds of repressions, not quite as bad as Turkey, but are happening pretty much everywhere, and it is the duty of the international community to help these governments or force these governments to enforce this fundamental right. Because if we don't have the ability, if citizens don't have the ability to voice their criticism, to voice their disagreement with their government, whether it's elected or not, it's going to create this bottled up pressure, and that is going to, in the long term, come back and face these governments and these regimes, which in much bigger waves. People need an outlet, and whether, you know, you have to give them some sort of outlet for this, and the streets should be one of it.
Among the groups the report saw as increasingly targeted by the government are LGBTI and women's rights advocates. Just last week, women across Turkey took to the streets again to protest the killing of 27-year-old student Pınar Gültekin by her former partner. Despite a number of similarly high-profile cases of murdered women that generated massive media coverage in recent years, the emergence of several women's advocacy groups and hashtags gone viral, at least since Özgecan Aslan in early 15, the number of women killed in Turkey has increased nearly fourfold, from 121 in 2011 to 474 last year, according to the watchdog group We Will Stop Femicide. While the number of Turkish women who have suffered violence has increased 50% over the last few years. And now, Turkish conservatives are calling on the Turkish government to pull out of the Istanbul Convention. It's widely seen as the most powerful global compact to combat violence against women, and Turkey was the first signatory in 2011. But Islamists say it undermines the family. Merve, somehow, despite waves of domestic and international attention, the situation for women in Turkey seems to keep worsening. Is that true? What can be done?
It is certainly true. All of the data that we're seeing corroborates this assertion. I mean, I saw recently a figure that something like 35 or 36% of all married women in Turkey face some sort of violence throughout their lives. This is a huge portion. This is unfortunately the case pretty much everywhere in the world, I have to say. I mean, the Istanbul Convention that you mentioned was really a radical agreement, and that was created and it was supposed to be implemented by the European, the Council of Europe. It was a Council of Europe convention. And it's because a lot of European countries have problems dealing with it too. In Turkey, I believe that the numbers that we're seeing are much, much worse. And this has to do with the level of impunity, I'm sorry to say, but the government has afforded the offenders of these sexual and gender based crimes, particularly since I would say 2016, after the state of emergency and under the new constitution. It's really, really hard for an average Turkish woman or gender minority to, if any kind of harassment or attack comes against their way on the street or anywhere in Turkey, for them to be able to trust that the law enforcement will come and be on their side. And this is what we're seeing these women chant when they take to the streets after these horrific crimes happen. The offenders are not punished. They're not punished properly. They're not jailed. Rape victims often have to deal with issues like inability to get an abortion, for example, or even to see that the perpetrator was jailed. We even see that those who are jailed are later given some amnesty and are let go early because in the court they show a quote unquote positive or good demeanor, for example. So there is a total double standard, and women are in no way protected, I have to say. So this is really on the government, and now they're talking about pulling out of the Istanbul Convention, which is already not properly implemented, and this is why we're seeing the picture that we're seeing, that the fact that it's not properly implemented. Now, after Turkey being the first signatory to such a radical agenda for change, they're saying that they have a problem with the way that the definition of gender as a socially constructed role is against Turkish values, is against Muslim religious values. Suddenly, they don't like that they find provisions, for example, in this convention that talk about that consider domestic violence to include those between married partners, for example, or those in the same household, but also those after divorce. So these are things that these ultra-religious conservatives. I don't want to call them conservatives because even pro-government conservatives can see what's wrong with these kinds of arguments. It's really coming from Islamist circles, I have to say, looking at this and saying it's too, the definition of domestic violence is too broad, the definition of gender is not according to our customs and religious values, and basically that this this document allows for, not just allows for, but promotes homosexuality, which is, of course, anyone who understands anything about homosexuality or sexual orientation knows that it's not something that you can basically promote or not promote. You have either a certain gender orientation or you don't. It's not something like, you know, picking up cigarettes. That you end up picking up. So I think it's incredibly disconcerting that Turkey is currently talking about, and Erdogan himself said that they should rethink the Istanbul Convention and pull out. I mean, given the picture for women and gender minorities and sexual minorities in Turkey right now, it is one of the most irresponsible things that a leader in a country like that can do to pull out. And of course, it's following the example of Poland, which itself says a lot.
Just to go back to a point you mentioned earlier in your answer, Erdogan vowed in a tweet last week that Gutekin's murderer would receive the maximum punishment. And as you say, women's advocacy groups in Turkey say this is one of the main problems, that the perpetrators of violence against women often get off with a slap on the wrist because of lightly enforced laws and a judiciary that still considers provocation a reasonable defense and examines, for instance, what the woman was wearing or what she had been doing at the time of the crime. To what extent do you think this compounds the problem for women? And also, is this sort of thing a problem in other countries? Is it particular to Turkey?
I mean, it's not particular to Turkey, but we have seen things in Turkey change so much under Erdogan that I think Turkey provides a really good case study as to what happens. Because let's face it, I mean, Turkey, before Erdogan, it was never really a place where women had full rights and could live as full citizens. I mean, in the 70s and 80s in Turkey, also you would have members of the law enforcement not necessarily trust a woman's victimhood, for example, or you know, put blame on women for inviting attacks or harassment per the way she dresses, wearing a small, you know, shorts or something like that. So this was always a problem in a place like Turkey. But with Erdogan and the AKP, we see so much sexism, the invectives against women, the constant language coming from Erdogan telling women to have 3 babies, 5 babies, stay at home. The previous members of the Turkish government, of Erdogan's government, would come out and say things like women should not be laughing in public. I mean, how do they think that this is going to help empower women in any way, particularly against those offenders who believe it's their right to harass or attack women for the way they dress or for having ideas that they do or for speaking the way they do, going to places that they do. So we have seen how an Islamist government with absolutely no respect for gender equality, full gender equality, turn a place like Turkey into, you know, from a difficult place for women into pretty much hell. I mean, it's not, I don't want to say, you know, when we talk about rape, we see India making headlines all the time, for example. So in terms of, I mean, when we look at gender discrimination and violence, Turkey is not the worst place on earth, but it's certainly not where it should be, given that Turkey is positioning itself in the international stage as one of the growing powers of the world, of the international community. It's portraying itself as aspiring to be a democratic republic with a large economy, good relations with the West, if not membership in the EU. So for a country with these, you know, aspirations, so-called aspirations, self-defined aspirations, it is a really, really bad record, what we see in Turkey. And I think it's you know, the fact that Erdogan or political leaders occasionally take up one case or another and go out and make these bombastic sort of claims, and they make an example of that one case, it I think actually hurts the general practice, because this should be not, you know, prosecutors should not go after a rapist or a murderer of women because Erdogan has a problem with that. It should be because this is law and because these women are protected by law, but there is no rule of law in Turkey. So yes, I mean, all of the cases are basically court cases proceed based on political motivations. And this is the major fundamental problem that women and all minorities, not just gender and sexual, all minorities are facing in Turkey.
Also today, the U.S. ambassador to Turkey, David Satterfield, visited Istanbul's iconic Hagia Sophia, which, as you mentioned earlier, Erdogan's government recently reconverted into a mosque. 2 weeks ago, you interviewed Eric Edelman, who served as U.S. ambassador to Turkey in the AKP's early years, 2003 to 2005, I believe, referring to former National Security Advisor John Bolton's new book, The Room Where It Happened. Edelman talked to you of just how frequently Trump and Erdogan have spoken in recent years, and also how White House to White Palace communications often occurred via the president's sons-in-law, White House advisor Jared Kushner and Turkish Treasury and Finance Minister Berat Albayrak. Edelman said that the strong family ties give Erdogan the idea that he has a get-out-of-jail-free card in regards to possible sanctions, either for Turkey's purchase of Russian air defense systems or for its Libya intervention, both of which have been discussed in the U.S. House and passed to some extent. Do you agree with this view? Do you see these family ties giving Erdogan an overconfidence? And what do you think more broadly that this tells us about U.S.-Turkey relations today?
Absolutely. I'm really happy you brought up this Q&A. I did this Q&A with Ambassador Edelman because I had the question of, I mean, this is very unusual for maybe a younger analyst like me to watch the relationship between Erdogan and Trump unfold. So I wanted to ask him, A, how strange is this for any U.S. leader to have with any leader? For example, the U.S. has a special, quote unquote, special relationship with the U.K. We know previous U.S. presidents like Bush had close relationships with many world leaders. And, you know, even Obama until in 2012 called Erdogan one of his top five leaders. So it's not strange for personal relationships in many cases to impact bilateral relationships at large. But I really do think, and Eric, you know, helped confirm this, that what we're seeing between Trump and Erdogan is highly unusual, not just for a U.S. leader's relationship with Turkey, but also in general. And this has to do with the person of Trump, Donald Trump, and the way he conducts basically the U.S. He conducts his business with the U.S. government as if it is a business of his, and that this is all of the decisions can be made between he and his particular counterpart, whether it's Erdogan or Vladimir Putin or Xi Jinping or anyone like that. And we know that Trump has no shortage of statements saying that he is enamored with all sorts of highly authoritarian populist leaders, and he himself likes acting like one inside the United States and abroad. So this is something that is, I think, very, very unusual and hopefully limited to Trump, because the relationship that they have, whether it's the family, so whether it's the actual sons-in-law's relationship or whether it's Trump and Erdogan's own relationship, their frequency of phone calls between the two and the way the phone calls take place, the way Erdogan thinks that he can at any time reach President Trump alone and basically get him to agree to any of his demands is something that issues all protocol, because it means that the personal relationship between these two men have come to transcend all levels of bureaucracy when it comes to foreign policy making in Turkey and in the United States. So I do think that this is going to be a limited, I actually hope that this will be a limited thing for the sake of the United States and its relationship and its foreign policy making in general, not just in terms of its relationship with Turkey. But one problem, the long-term problem that we see of this steering the relationship between the personhoods, for example, of Trump and Erdogan in the case of Turkey, is that we have bureaucracies in the U.S. So we have the Congress, we have the State Department and the Defense Department openly disagreeing with some of the policies that President Trump, that the White House has enacted because of his relationship with Erdogan. We do not have, the State Department and the Defense Department and Congress do not view Erdogan or Turkey in the same way that Trump does, which creates the question of what's going to happen to U.S.-Turkish relations after Trump leaves, because whoever comes next is going to have to take into account their own bureaucracies and their own governments when they are devising a foreign policy towards Turkey. So it's going to necessarily be different, very different than Trump's attitude towards Turkey. And also, they might, particularly if they come from the Democratic Party, they might harbor some resentment towards Erdogan's cultivation of these very friendly relations with Trump at the expense of the rest of the U.S. government.
Well, yeah, that's a good lead into my next question. Let's take a look down the road a bit. Recent polls put Biden, Democrat Party, Joe Biden candidate, 14 or 15 points ahead of Trump. Let's say these numbers hold and Trump loses in November. My guess is that President Joe Biden would be more supportive of, say, Greece and the European Union, and less likely to be friendly, to be pals with Erdogan like Trump, and favor him on the S-400, the Eastern Mediterranean, Libya, and other issues. Would you agree with that? How do you see a Biden presidency, which could happen now 6 months from now, reshaping U.S.-Turkey ties?
Yes, I mean, in many ways, as you know, observers from outside of it, we're lucky that it is Biden, because we have a track record of him as part of the administration in dealing with Turkey. So I would agree with you that, given Biden's track record, that he's going to be more sympathetic towards Greece. He's going to be in the Eastern Mediterranean when it comes to the skirmishes with Turkey. He's going to be more, sympathetic and supportive of, should there be space in the United States Syria policy, towards Syrian Kurds, for example. When it comes to Russia and the S-400s, he's going to be less interested in appeasing Turkey for the very, adult decision that Erdogan made to purchase the S-400 system despite a year of warnings coming from all levels of the U.S. government that this will trigger sanctions under U.S. law. And so I think Biden is going to be more interested in actually implementing U.S. law, unlike the current president that we have, and also pay attention to international norms. And I think the Biden administration, most importantly, kind of maybe tying it back to the beginning of our conversation, is going to be paying more attention to the domestic developments in Turkey and countries like Turkey. He's going to care about, how democratically an ally of the United States is actually being governed. He understands that Turkey divided society, and there is basically a half of the population that isn't allowed to have any sort of contribution to Turkey's domestic or foreign policies, is unable to not only contribute to policy making, but not even critique it increasingly. And these are going to be, in the eyes of the Trump administration, this is, I guess, normal behavior, like the CEO of a country trying to keep their CEO of a company trying to keep their restless employees at bay. But for President Biden, who actually cares about democratic values and human rights all around the world, but also in the United States, I think he is going to care about these issues, and he's going to be, ideally, hopefully, like the Obama administration, more outspoken when it comes to Erdogan's transgressions against these fundamental rights and values, like with the social media law, like with leaving the Istanbul Convention, and frankly, like converting Hagia Sophia into a mosque.
I wonder then who Erdogan would prefer, if he has a preference over Trump or Biden. I mean, my initial thought was that he would prefer Trump to win because it sounds like, as you say, that Biden would apply more pressure in terms of sanctions and free speech and these issues, human rights issues. But at the same time, the U.S. applying those pressures would play right into Erdogan's conspiracy theories, anti-Western theories, and in a way could generate more nationalist support for him.
That's true. And this is a conundrum for all of Turkey's European and transatlantic friends and allies, really, of and this has been for a long time, of how to deal with a leader like Erdogan, who, if you do push back, can spin anything you do to his domestic audience as, you know, America hating Turkey, and this is why they are working with the Syrian Kurds in the first place, and this is why, they've always supported Greek Cypriots over Turkish Cypriots and whatnot. The challenge, in the way I see this, and I think most analysts who look at it, not from these governments and not the actual decision makers, but people who, help inform their thinking, the way we see it is that there's no winning by appeasing a leader like Erdogan. He is going to present anything and everything that America does as regardless of what America does, he's going to continue, and his media is going to continue to portray America as a threat to Turkey. The only difference is whether he's presenting America as a short-term threat, a medium-long threat, or a long-term threat. But in any case, it's going to be a threat. So if the U.S. imposes sanctions on Turkey, there's always going to be some spin around this, saying that this is the United States trying to hurt Turkey for effectively pursuing its own national interest, quote unquote, or defending its, again, quote unquote, national sovereignty. Because I do not believe, as a Turkish citizen, that Erdogan is doing either of these things. And I do not believe that having the Russian S-400s on Turkish soil is in any way helping protect Turkey's national security. In fact, it's damaging. It's by damaging its relations with NATO, which Turkey really, really needs and has benefited from immensely. So I think when we're dealing with a leader like Erdogan, we have to accept that is going to be the spin. And all the United States and Turkey's European partners can do here is to act consistently. That is the only way that they can show the Turkish people that what they're trying to do is help, not hurt the Turkish citizen. And the only way to do that is, I think, by implementing their own laws. The United States, I'm not excited at the prospect of Turkey getting sanctioned, and the Turkish economy.
Sorry, I was just going to say, I mean, if you want to help not hurt the Turkish citizens, I think sanctions might hurt them, right?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely will. It will definitely hurt the Turkish economy. But at the same time, I mean, this is U.S. law. It says that if a country engages in this large of a purchase with the Russian Defense Ministry, and particularly with a Russian company that is already sanctioned by the U.S., there's really no getting around it. If the U.S. doesn't implement its own law and gives Erdogan a free pass on this, then I think after that point, yes, sure, every time the U.S. does anything punitive towards Turkey, then the Turkish government can portray that as selective punishment and not acting in accordance with their own laws. So this is, I'm not excited about the fact that the U.S. might sanction and probably will sanction Turkey because of the S-400s, but look, the U.S. government on multiple levels has been warning the Turkish government, not just Erdogan, but everybody around him, that this is going to happen. And Erdogan goes and makes this decision anyway, and he makes it thinking he can actually get away with it. So there is, if we're talking about what is just and unjust here, there is some sort of impunity and injustice in this entire scenario. It's really similar. Turkey, one of the biggest arguments that the Turkish government levels against the United States is that the U.S. has partnered with Syrian Kurds in order to, create a Kurdish insurgency inside Turkey or something somehow break Turkey's territory and create a Kurdistan and whatnot. The reality is that the United States partnered with Syrian Kurds because Turkey failed over and again to do its own duties and help the fight, the global fight against ISIS in Syria. In fact, Turkey's policies allowed for a threat like ISIS and other jihadist groups to grow just along the Turkish border. And this is why the United States decided to work with a local partner that actually had an interest in combating this global jihadist threat, this really actual imperialist threat that ISIS presented to the world with territorial expansionist vision. So, look, Erdogan will have his own spin when it comes to whatever the US does or whatever the EU does. But if the US and the EU are consistent in their approach to Turkey and in their approach to implementing international and their own domestic laws and acting according to those legal frameworks, I think only then can they actually get through to the Turkish people and show that they aren't just trying to hurt Turkey for the sake of hurting Turkey because they hate Turkey or they're jealous of Turkey's growing power, which is one of the funniest things Erdogan has ever said to his own people, that anyone would be jealous of Turkey right now. That's the only way of getting past this propaganda, this spin. And I think that, you know, the Obama administration was more able to do this. With the Trump administration, there is no law, no procedure, no protocol. So everything is kind of up for grabs. We're living in a strange world. So Erdogan is able to just take a phone call and get away with anything he wants. But when we see any next administration, I hope that the United States' own politics will normalize and we will start seeing a leader who is accountable to his or her own government, own bureaucracy, own Congress, own legislature, and own public opinion and bound by international laws and norms.
Mm-hmm. So you think the U.S. and the West should be maybe a little bit more willing to lean towards the stick rather than the carrot?
Whether it's stick or a carrot, David, they have to be consistent in how they do it. You know, this is, I think, the problem. I don't think it should always be a stick, but, you know, it's very hard to offer any carrots right now to those sections of Turkish civil society or opposition, given how closed of a space Turkey is becoming and a closed society it's becoming. So, I mean, we have to see, I think, in a realistic way that, you know, from the point of view of the transatlantic community, they're dealing with a dangerous actor like Erdogan, who's not only repressing his own people, but is increasingly aggressive abroad. And the Eastern Mediterranean is just one theater where we see that. And they're going to have to, I mean, it's not going to be smooth sailing between Turkey and any of these countries. So, you know, I'm just trying to find a way to, you know, how can we go through this process where these countries, these friends of Turkey, again, I'm going to underline, push back against Erdogan in a way that doesn't alienate the Turkish public. That's going to be incredibly hard to do given Erdogan's control over the information space in Turkey. But I think the only way of doing it is by actually having honest policies.
Mm-hmm. It's a complex spider web of interrelated issues in Turkey and U.S. relations and Turkey and Western relations. And we could talk about it for hours, but let's leave it there. I've kept you long enough. Merve Tahiroğlu of the Project on Middle East Democracy, thank you so much for your time and insight. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure to talk with you, David.
You can follow Ahval News Online podcast series through Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, Google Podcasts, SoundCloud, and Spreaker. All you need to know about Turkey is here, for your ears, mind, and attention. Thank you for listening to our podcast.